From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, it's all about las mujeres, women. As Latinas, we're now an economic powerhouse, and we're social and cultural chameleons with data to prove it. 86% of Latinas say they're the primary decision makers in their households, which means Latinas hold the lion's share of spending power in the trillion-dollar Latino market. So does that mean Latinas can have it all?
You know, be yourself, don't change how you look, but you gotta, you know, put on a black pantsuit for this and smaller jewelry.
Barnard Women's College President Deborah Spar coming up. Also, Latinas and body image, nude shoes for non-white women, and so much more. Today on Latino USA, no se vayan. Welcome to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today, las mujeres. There's been a lot written in the past year about women balancing work and family, but what that means for Latinas can be complicated, especially in the world of business. Do you tone it down? How much do you lean in before you're pushed back? I sat down with one woman who seems to have made it. She's got kids, a career, a husband, and a new book. Deborah Spar is the president of Barnard College, a liberal arts college for women in New York City, and, full disclosure, my alma mater. What can I say? I am a Barnard girl. Her book, Wonder Woman, Sex, Power, and the Quest for Perfection, is available now. Welcome to Latino USA, Deborah.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I was quoting you to my daughter.
Uh-oh.
My 15-year-old daughter, who is a very high-performing, loves to, you know, in her words, loves to do everything with passion. So she will work on an essay for her humanities class for 8 hours. And I was quoting her that in your book, you say that by the time young women get to college now, get to Barnard College, they're exhausted. And this is at the core of what you're saying is what's happening, not with young women, but with all women in our country.
Right. And I think, you know, it's a little bit more subtle than that, because if your daughter is totally passionate about her English paper and she's loving it and the minutes and the hours are just flying by, then all power to her. If she's making herself crazy, though, that's when I would get more worried. And, you know, that's what I'm trying to argue in the book, is that we should let our kids and ourselves be as ambitious and as driven as we want to be in some areas of our lives. But you can't be driven and ambitious in every area of your life. So maybe your daughter shouldn't be going out for the varsity soccer team if she's really spending all her time on her English papers.
So your book, it's very academic, but it is also about your life. So what have you given up then, you personally?
Well, I've given up different things at different points in my life. You know, I had to leave my first job, which is a very high-risk thing to do as an academic. I took a job at the University of Toronto, and I was commuting. My husband had a job in a different city, and I had a one-year-old. And even though I had chosen a job I loved, I left after a year, which was incredibly painful to do. But I wasn't willing to sacrifice my family or my marriage or my health, quite frankly, to be commuting back and forth.
So what about the women who don't have a choice? They're carrying all the weight on their shoulders. What about them? Or do you say, you know what, this isn't a conversation that every woman in the United States can have?
No, I really think this is a conversation that applies across races, across socioeconomic status. And I've been really happy that the early response to the book has been really diverse. I'm hearing from wealthy women and poor women and working women and stay-at-home moms, because I think at some level, it is women like myself who do have the luxury of being able to make choices, who can say it's okay to make trade-offs. And working women are going to have to make harder trade-offs, but they still have the ability to make choices. So yes, they may not be able to hire people to do their housework, but they don't have to be perfect housekeepers. one thing, the most important thing I'm trying to do with the book is help women stop feeling guilty all the time. Because I don't think guilt is something that attaches only to particular socioeconomic groups. I see women from across the spectrum feeling guilty. And I think particularly the women you're describing who are holding their families together and working really tough jobs and don't have a lot of additional cash, they're the ones, first of all, who shouldn't be feeling guilty because they are doing everything already.
So what about men in the equation?
Yeah, and actually, men play a pretty large role in this book because one of the things I'm arguing is that we have to bring men into the equation. If we make the, quote, women's problem an issue that only women have to solve, we're never going to get there because men are part of the situation. Men still hold the majority of positions of power. And I do think, you know, the good news here is that most men want to solve the problem now. I don't think we're any more in the bad old days when there were men sitting in the corner office plotting how to keep the women out. Most men I've worked with and most men I know, they want their wives to succeed. They want their daughters to succeed. They want the young women they've mentored to succeed. So I think women have to do a better job of actually telling men what the problems are. And men have to listen and participate. But, you know, sometimes what happens in large organizations is that there are women's groups or diversity groups, and they are only participated in by the women or the underrepresented minorities. That will never get you anywhere. We need to bring the white men into these conversations and tell them how they can help.
So with Latinas, there is a complicated thing that goes on. And we didn't actually do a lot in terms of the Sheryl Sandberg book, Lean In. But for many Latinas, it can be an issue. If you are a Latina and you lean in, immediately you're going to be saying, oh my God, she's just so pushy, mm-hmm. of course. And then that has all kinds of other residual impacts.
First of all, I think all women run the risk of being perceived as pushy or bossy when they step up in the workplace. Maybe particularly acute for Latinas, but I think it cuts across the board. I'm Jewish, so certainly, you know, Jewish bossy women have a long history of falling into this trap. But I'm not in any way saying that women should pull back. I think women, if they are ambitious, if they want to be in the workplace, if they want to have professional careers, they should push full steam ahead. What I'm saying is that if we decide to push full steam ahead in the workplace, we're going to have to cut back in other areas of our lives. So if you want to give the best presentation at the office tomorrow, don't worry about cleaning the house tonight. That's what I'm saying. I'm not telling women at all to step back. I'm saying that if you really want to push ahead, you're going to have to make trade-offs elsewhere.
So I get this question a lot too. How do you do it all? What's it like to have it all? And I always say, you know what? You're having it all because in your mind, you're convinced that at that moment, you're having it all. Like there's and you're just like, my God, this is amazing, exciting. This is what life feels like. But it doesn't mean that there isn't a huge fire that is burning around the corner with, you name it, your family, your pet, your whatever, you know, there is some fire burning someplace.
Well, we've started joking in my office that we're going to start a hashtag having it all. And the things that we'll post there are not these moments of joy, they're the moments of chaos. Because, you know, I start the book with this very unglamorous story of just having had my second child.
It's a great scene.
This is the reality. I'm in the ladies' bathroom at LaGuardia Airport, you know, trying to deal with my suit that doesn't fit and a breast pump and, you know, the people around me who don't know what I'm doing. But those are the moments of having it all. Having it all is not very glamorous. Having it all means you're kind of crazed. And again, that's not a bad thing to go for. But, you know, I really do believe that, you know, the moments of greatest joy in our lives are not when we're multitasking. The moments of greatest joy is when we're walking on a beach or sitting on the couch with someone we love. You know, having a life that involves a high-pressured career and a family and other accessories on the side is complicated and hard and exhausting. And that's fine, but I don't think we should glamorize having it all because it's really not that glamorous.
And for women of color who particularly say, and then there's this added thing, what do you say to them?
I think it's really tough. And I think, you know, one of the things that I spend a fair amount of time on in the book, more than I thought I would, is the extent to which women are still chained to certain expectations of how they should look in the workforce. There's a very scary slide I show when I make presentations about this, where it's one of the magazines that does, you know, the 50 most powerful women. And it's photos of these women. They all look alike. even if they're Latina, if they're Black, if they're biracial.
I had never thought of
it's
that.
It's terrifying. They're, you know, wow. The standards of what a working woman should look like are essentially still white, Caucasian, thin. You know, you're not allowed to be successful in fat. You're not allowed to be successful and have curly hair, unless it's really gorgeous curly hair. You're not allowed to be successful and you know, be in any way disabled. So I think the standards around physicality are particularly hard for African-American women, for darker-skinned women, for ethnic-looking women. And even, you know, I'm white, but I'm ethnic enough looking that, as I describe in the book, you know, I had to spend an absurd amount of time dealing with my hair, which left to its own devices, is very curly and very frizzy, and is not quite acceptable in certain workplaces. Not that anyone would call you out on it, but I think we are still overly constrained by the picture of what a successful working woman looks like. And she's white and kind of Anglo.
So if you're different and you want to succeed, what to do?
I think this is hard. And I think this is one where a little bit of compromise at this point in time is probably wise. And I was counseling a young Dominican woman a couple of years ago, fabulous young woman, a real superstar. And she was going for a big interview. And I actually sort of took her aside and I said, you have to dress differently. You know, be yourself. Don't change how you look. But you got to, you know, put on a black pantsuit for this and smaller jewelry. And she was amazing. And she, you know, she just adopted it and has been thus far incredibly successful. So I think you do have to take your cues. If you're working at an investment bank, you know, there is a dress code. If you're working in the media industry, there's a dress code, but it's one that allows for bigger earrings and shorter skirts. So I think as women are still trying to make their way in the workplace, and women of color are having a particularly rocky road towards making their way in the workplace, you kind of do have to conform to the social cues because dress codes exist everywhere. But, you know, start experimenting at the margin and be bolder as you get older.
Well, that is the thing. I mean, once you get older, then you can make more of a statement at that time.
That's
but of
right.
course, that's why I chose never to work in the business world because, you know, the big earrings, just I could not.
and this is a great example of choices. You know, if it's really important to you to manifest your identity in a certain way, go into an area where that will be valued rather than constantly an obstacle.
So you say that you believe right now women that the issues that they face are not so much due to any kind of government policy or inaction, or in fact, even overt discrimination.
No, there's still clearly deeply embedded suspicion of women in the workplace, and I think particularly suspicion of women of color. I very much wish I had a magic wand that I could wave and make all discrimination go away tomorrow. You know, I'd like to hold out for major governmental change. But because I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, I'm trying to come up with other strategies that women can take, that men can take, that organizations can take, which will at least move us closer to an ideal situation, even if we don't quite get there.
Deborah Spar, thank you so much for your work and for joining us in the studios here at the Futuro Media Group in Harlem on Latino USA.
Thank you so much.
Yo soy mujer, esta es mi historia, me gusta hablar y andar de taco alto, me gusta mi sensualidad, qué barbaridad, conquistar los chicos si se ven bien, soy una mujer.
Coming up, Latinas and our bodies.
They're looking at my nails, they're looking at my legs, they're making sure that I look proper.
Beauty standards, and yes, the unlikely conversation about body hair and being Latina. Stay with us.
Looking.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today it's all about mujeres, the women. And while women of any race or ethnicity have to deal with their weight, their shape, their height, for Latinas, our culture brings up some complicating factors. So we decided to bring in a couple of blogueras to talk about body image and being a Latina. Joining us now in our Harlem studio, Patricia Baloy, who writes at patriciabaloy.blogspot.com. Hello, Patricia, de nuevo.
Hello, thank you for having me back.
And from KQED in San Francisco, Cassandra Peña, who writes at lovekcp.wordpress.com. Hola, Cassandra.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Great. So, Patricia, you wrote an entry in your blog about a very particular situation that you had to deal with as a Latina and body hair. What's the story, your story behind body hair?
So I'm engaged and my fiance is an Egyptian man. And we decided to go to Egypt, see his family and have like our engagement party there. In the days before, everybody was like getting ready, you know, you have to prepare for the beauty salon and your makeup and this and your dress and your shoes. So, you know, I guess they started looking at my body because they wanted to dress me. And it was very awkward, but they started looking closely.
Let me interrupt you. So they actually had you down to your calzones kind of thing?
Pretty much. They're just like looking at me, like they're looking at my nails, they're looking at my legs, they're making sure that I look proper because I'm going to be presented to like the entire family and they want me to look as good as possible. And as a fiercely independent feminist who grew up in Brooklyn, I'm like, don't touch me. And I had to kind of make sure that I wasn't being rude. So I kind of let them. And then, you know, they grab my arms and they see that I have little hairs, right? And it was like startling. Like, I cannot
like
believe
normal,
that you have
normal
that.
Arm hair, normal, regular arm hair. And they looked at you and said,
well, it was like, oh, you know, we have to get this removed. I'm like, why?
Actually, it got a little bit more intense, Patricia, because then it was not just arm hair. It was suddenly...
It was everything. They wanted to remove my face hair, which I didn't know I had until I looked very, very closely in a magnifying mirror and noticed that apparently we have a very soft hair on our faces, you know, and eyebrows and upper lip. And this is something that we deal with facially. And I'm not against, you know, grooming. Go ahead. You don't have to walk around with a mustache if you don't want to. I don't want to. But there's like that extra level that I won't go. Like, I'm not going to strip my cheeks off of like baby hair. And it was it goes beyond that, too. And I know my blog post, I kind of kept it kind of PC. But it does go beyond just visible hair until.
Okay, she doesn't want to say it, but she's talking about everything below the belt.
Below the belt, yes. And that is something that is done in Arab cultures to girls that are about to get married because it's considered unhygienic and not pleasant for your future husband. And I'm like, that's okay, ladies, really.
Okay, fun. You can't see my face right now, but my face is cringing. So, Cassandra, you're listening to this story for the first time. What's going on for you? Because you are not just a blogger and you work with, you know, young Latinas on nutrition and health, but you also are Miss San Jose Latina.
You know, I just think it's so hilarious because, you know, you're not very aware of the type of body hair or how much you have until someone else points it out. I frequently get my eyebrows threaded, primarily done by Persian women. And, you know, I'll just go in and say, oh, I just want to get my eyebrows done. And they always seem to say, well, what about this? What about that? Just your eyebrows? Are you sure? And so it kind of makes me feel, well, yeah, just my eyebrows. What else am I supposed to get?
So, Cassandra, you actually, even though you're in the beauty pageant business life, you spend a lot of time working with middle school girls to begin to talk with them about being a middle school Latina and feeling proud about their bodies. So what do you tell them? And do you see that already in middle school, it is already an issue?
Oh, yes. You know, I actually had an experience earlier this year. I'm not so sure if you ladies are familiar with the whole trend of a thigh gap.
Right. Yes, I am.
A trend? What do you mean a trend? I mean,
yes.
I know what a thigh gap is, but what do you mean there's a trend?
So unfortunately, that's the new hottest thing that a lot of young women are striving for, which is to have a gap between your thighs. And that's supposed to mean that you're skinny. That it's just very disturbing. And so one of the activities that I do, I'm working with All Girls Club, and we're just doing so many things on female empowerment, on body image, and teen sexting, and everything else that the girls are being involved with these days.
So not eating all that processed food all the time, but really thinking about working out, not because you want to lose weight, but because working out makes you feel good, right? Is that what you're trying to tell these young women? Are they receptive?
Yes. I started a running club. You know, I'm motivating them every lap that they do. They know I bring my own food. I never have those hot Cheetos. I never have soda. I'm always bringing my own drinks, my own fruit, my chicken. And they know, oh, Miss Cassie brings her own stuff. Don't even ask her if she wants candy because she's not going to eat it. And if a leader who they look up to and like, if she's doing it, then maybe they can start doing it too.
Now with the whole social media and the way that kids are taking photographs of themselves, and Patricia, you know, part of your life is living in the new media. So how do you put those two things together where there is now, the media is everywhere, and instead of bombarding our young women with all kinds of images of everyone who looks different, in fact, a lot of it is still fit this norm.
It's difficult, but I think what I do best is just calling out media. When I see any kind of body shaming, I'll just start pointing things out that people take for granted as the status quo, or it's like, no, that's okay. That's the standard. That's how everybody should be. Because people don't really know that they can question that. Recently in New York City, we have the campaign that Bloomberg came out with, was the I'm a Girl. And it shows young girls being themselves, being beautiful, being who they are, no makeup, no airbrush, you know. And it was just kind of defining them by what they love to do and who they are as a person, not what they look like. And just if you support those things and openly support them, not just say you do, but kind of, give a different image in front of people, it will make a difference. People will get it.
Well, Patricia and Cassandra, thank you so much for joining us to talk about Latinas and our bodies. It was great.
Thank you so much. It was so much fun.
Thank you.
Patricia Baloy writes at patriciabaloy.blogspot.com, and Cassandra Peña, who is Miss San Jose Latina, writes at lovecassiep.wordpress.com. So, do you know Molly? You might have heard the name dropped in songs by artists like Kanye West and Miley Cyrus. Of course, Molly isn't a woman. Molly is a drug. For this week's News or Noise, our regular segment on news literacy, producer Daisy Rosario spoke with young journalists in Chicago about their reporting on a drug that's growing in popularity.
If you listen to some hip-hop and pop songs, it might sound like a bunch of musicians have the same friend, Molly. You wouldn't be alone in thinking this.
They asked me who Molly was. They didn't ask me what it was. They asked me who it was.
Rand Jassar got that reaction from adults when she showed them a story she had worked on about the pure form of MDMA, or ecstasy, popularly known as Molly. She is one of three students who wrote the story for The Mash, a weekly newspaper for teens published by the Chicago Tribune. Jassar didn't know much about Molly before the topic came up, but Catherine Kwa had heard of Molly because of its association with EDM, electronic dance music.
My brother is a really big fan of EDM music, so I knew a bit of the ins and outs of it.
But she didn't realize that the drug itself is a big draw for some concertgoers.
Please help me find Molly.
So it was really shocking for me to find out that some people go especially for that.
In fact, when two young people died at an EDM festival in New York this summer, their deaths were linked to Molly. As reporters for The Mash, they went through the steps any journalist would when writing a news story. They started with research. Gabrielle Abasamis started with what was given to them by their editor.
I definitely read through all the material that Morgan gave me. I wanted to write it in an angle where I would be able to explain what the drug is to people, because Molly is kind of an up-and-coming drug.
They all helped. talking to sources.
I did some of the dirty work and interviewed two girls. So I looked up some psychiatrists for like drug counseling and stuff. He gave us a lot of good resources and quotes.
And they hit some of the same roadblocks that professional journalists often do.
Originally, I wanted to look for some sources that had to do with law enforcement, but I couldn't get a hold of anybody.
And persevering.
Talking to people it's a part of the job. It's a little difficult sometimes, but when you let them speak, they say some amazing things that can really advance the story.
Then they ask themselves if their coverage was objective.
When you write a story, you can't just write from one angle. Since we had quotes from students who used Molly and we had quotes from a doctor, I wanted to look for somebody who knew about it but didn't necessarily use it.
It was just really cool working on this because I felt like I myself got to understand a lot more.
Jasar even started hearing references to the drug in places she hadn't before.
Well, I listened to Miley Cyrus's song, and I never really thought that maybe she said, like, you know, dancing with Molly. I always thought I was dancing with Miley. Dancing with Molly. Like, listen to her song again. I thought it was very weird how she kind of put it in a way that people would not probably notice unless they actually, like, know what the drug is.
Just because teens talk about the drug doesn't mean they're using it. Abisama says they might just be quoting lyrics.
Yeah, it's from the songs. I mean, I obviously can't speak for the whole generation, but most of my friends and most of the people that I'm surrounded by listen to hip hop and that kind of music. But I have, you know, I know people who have Instagram names that are like Pop Damali, but like, you know, they're in AP classes and they stay home on the weekends and they probably don't know anything about it really.
All three young women plan to pursue journalism as a career. Their drug of choice is reporting and the pressures that come with it.
I love deadlines because they really get you going. They make you want to I don't know how to describe it. It's like a rush, you know, like you want to do something really quickly. And in the end, you are really proud of yourself when you see your article in a newspaper.
For Latino USA, I'm Daisy Rosario.
And now a little conversation about a different and way less serious type of addiction. Many of us hate to admit it, but our shoes do matter.
The world of high fashion is often criticized as being inaccessible or insensitive to people of color. Legendary supermodels Naomi Campbell and Iman called out some of the biggest fashion designers for not including people of color in their fashion campaigns. And a recent lawsuit has been filed against the high-end department store Barney's for discriminating against shoppers of color. Even Oprah Winfrey has been part of the mix, saying that a boutique in Switzerland refused to let her see an expensive handbag, saying that she couldn't afford it. But dun-da-da-dum. The world's most famous luxury shoe designer has taken a step in the right direction. Christian Louboutin has a new design for a line of 5 nude shoes to match a range of skin tones, because we all have different shades of skin when we are in the nude, and we need to have a shoe that matches. Veronica Marche Miller writes about fashion for ExoJane.com, and she joins us to talk about this on our very first ever Latino USA interview about fashion and high-end shoes. Welcome to Latino USA, Veronica.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you write about fashion, and this for you is a very big deal, the fact that there will be 5 different shades of Louboutin nude shoes. Why is it such a big deal?
I mean, right, it's shoes. So, you know, at first glance, it may not seem like a big deal. But the big deal is that he recognizes and embraces the fact that nude isn't the same for everybody. It's not the same for you, for me, for everyone. The controversy over nude started a couple of years ago in 2010 when nude was the hot color of the spring. And every designer was using it and every magazine was highlighting it. But that nude only really meant nude for white women. So even using the color nude itself as we know it is very exclusionary. So the fact that Christian Louboutin is including all of these shades. It's just shifting the paradigm.
And the big deal around nude as a look is what?
Well, nude is your utility go-to shade, especially when it comes to shoes. It makes your legs look longer. It works for, you know, daytime when you go into the office, and it works for when you're going out. So it's your good all-around utility player. And people in fashion have been praising, you know, the nude shoe for years. So that's the huge deal. The problem is that if you're a brown girl or if you're a tan girl, the nude shoes that are usually on the market are not nude for you.
So how has the fashion world taken the news that Louboutin is making nude shoes for darker colored women?
I think everyone's really excited about it. I am, you know, part of a really diverse group of people who work in and study fashion. It's like a breath of fresh air that somebody is recognizing that, yes, women of color also love luxury shoes. They love high-end shoes and high-end fashion. And it's a major brand saying, hey, we see you and we want to make this for you.
All right. So I have to reveal that, you know, earlier in my life, my husband did nickname me Imeldita over Imelda Marcos and her shoe collection. So I have been known, although I have never paid, I'm revealing, I have never paid $500 for a pair of shoes. Mm-hmm. And that's what Christian Louboutin's start at. So they're pretty inaccessible for most women.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, they're inaccessible for me, too. You know, my best friend and I dream of the day when we can go to the store together and buy our matching Louboutins. You know what I mean? But that's the thing about Louboutin. It's an aspirational brand. So even though it's out of reach for most of us who love fashion, the companies that serve the department store market are watching these high-end brands to see what they do so they can offer it to the customer at a lower price point. There is some hope that someone at Nine West or someone at Aldo or, you know, whatever your favorite shoe brand is watching and is going to do the same thing in a year or so.
So the idea is that soon all of us will probably have access to a nude shoe in multiple different shades. And that is really a big market changer in so many ways.
Oh, absolutely. You know, women of color love fashion just as much as the next girl. But when you're a minority, there's a political aspect to it. You hear about the designers who aren't very sensitive using blackface in ad campaigns or not using minority models in ad campaigns. So there's all these other things that women of color who love fashion have to think about. So this thing right here actually just kind of makes it easier to support a brand because we know that brand supports us.
In the same time when people are being followed around in stores or making that accusation, for example, at Barney's, he's saying, I'm opening myself up to you. I want you. I see you as my market.
Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly what you said. He's saying, I see you and I'm embracing you. And no matter what, you know, industry you're talking about, how powerful is that? You know what I mean? To be validated in that way, even if it is just getting a pair of pumps, having a shoe designer saying, I see you, I made this for you. It's, you know, it's game changing.
I love that. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Veronica, on our first Latino USA conversation about shoes. I just love it. And it was really so smart. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Veronica Marche Miller writes about fashion for XOJane.com. Coming up on Latino USA, the facts are in. Latinas are an economic powerhouse.
Estas fiestas, tu regalo es verlos felices. Comparte su emoción y visita toyfeliz.com para más ahorros.
Why this matters to companies like toymaker Mattel. Stay with us.
Escucho nada, labios.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Well, a sweet little boy peeks under the Christmas tree. He's waiting for Santa Claus to come.
Estoy esperando. Estoy portando mal bien.
This is the latest holiday ad campaign from Mattel, the toy giant that makes Barbies, Hot Wheels, and Fisher-Price. It's their first Spanish-language campaign, and it's aiming for the hearts and the wallets of Latina moms.
Estas fiestas, tu regalo es verlos felices.
Estoy feliz.
Comparte su emoción y visita toyfeliz.com.
The slogan?
Estoy feliz.
As in, estoy feliz. I'm happy. According to Nielsen, the market research company, 86% of Latinas are the primary shoppers in their household. That puts Latinas in the driver's seat of the trillion-dollar Latino market. And America's moms are increasingly Latinas. Nearly 60% of Latino families have kids under the age of 18. For white women, that number's only 40%. In an interview with the New York Times, Mattel's vice president, Lisa McKnight, says business had been slow over the last few years, but when they saw Latinos buying about 15% of toys, they decided to reach out to Latina moms more directly. The Spanish language commercial will run on Univision in Houston, Los Angeles, and Miami. Mattel is also rolling out radio ads and a Toy Feliz website. But Nielsen says Latinas don't just have economic power, they've got social power too. For the first time in history, Latinas are enrolling in college at a higher rate than non-Latina women. A record 7 in 10 Latina high school graduates are enrolling in higher education. In another two generations, no single ethnic group will be a majority in the United States, and 30% of American women will be Latinas. So how will this educated young population change our nation? Well, compañeras, I want to hear from you. How about flexing your social and economic muscles by sending us a tweet and telling us how you do it? We are Latino USA. And now, mujeres, building confidence in ourselves and how talking to yourself, well, I do it all the time in private, can actually help us take it to the next level. This is the story of Anissa Guajardo, who was chosen for a soccer scholarship at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. But then she hit a bit of a rut. Instead of giving up, though, one day in her junior year, she had one of those moments athletes need to pull through, saying to herself, okay, I can't give up. I just can't. I will work harder. Now, Guajardo is a player for the Mexican national soccer team, and Leanna Carrasco is a sports and fitness writer who profiled Anissa in the latest issue of Bigger, Faster, Stronger magazine. And they both joined me on Latino USA. So Anissa, let's start with you. You grew up playing soccer in Mexico, in El Salvador, in California Central Valley, three very different places. You're tall, blue-eyed, Mexicana. So I'm just wondering how you put all of those things together and how that affects your identity, not only as a person and as a Latina, but as a soccer player.
Well, Maria, people would not recognize me and don't recognize me as Mexican. They hear me speaking Spanish or I say a certain word with an accent and they look at me and they go, "You speak Spanish?" I can't tell you how many times that's happened to me, but I take pride in the fact that I am Mexican, even though I may not appear it.
So how does that affect you as a soccer player then?
Well, growing up in California, it wasn't difficult at all. Sometimes we'd play teams that were filled with Mexican players, and I'd hear them speak Spanish, and they think that my team didn't speak Spanish, so they would try to talk plays. And then I could always be the one relaying those plays back to my team, being like, all right, this is what they're going to do, what they're thinking. So that was always
so
a positive.
So you were being a little bit of a spy, huh?
Well, you gotta use what you have. So in California, it was fine. But then when I started playing for Mexico, that's when things, I think, started getting a little different.
It's a different environment, Anissa, when you think about how people here in the United States take in soccer versus how soccer is consumed in Mexico. So what about that in terms of how Mexicanos take in the sport of soccer and how it's taken in here in the United States?
It's so different. In the United States, soccer is just considered another sport. In Mexico, it's just that country has been playing it for so long and takes so much pride in it that it just, when I go there, just rejuvenates me. Here, it's just people think it as a pastime, as and then women's soccer, that's a whole other issue with people don't take it seriously, and I think it's male soccer underwater. And
so I'm sorry, I'd never heard that before. Male soccer underwater?
Because
what does that mean?
Because it's so slow.
Liana, you were particularly taken with this story. As a sports writer for Bigger, Faster, Stronger, you've actually found that there are other women in sports who have this same kind of motivation. And you talk a lot about a coach by the name of Pat Summitt. So who is Pat Summitt and what did she do to inspire you to basically be like Anissa and say, I'm going to keep going no matter what?
She was the head women's basketball coach at the University of Tennessee, the winningest coach in college basketball. She's won, I believe, over 1,000 victories and I think 8 NCAA titles. I read one of her books and she has a section in there about a good coach will challenge an athlete to figure out what their real limits are, not just what they think they are, because we will all set our own limits lower than what they really are. And we can excel beyond that and perform at higher levels than we would ever imagine. It's important to remember that for athletes, you know, as we push ourselves and we think we're there at the end, we can go further. But it's also important to find a good mentor or coach who can push us and get us to that peak level of success.
So Anissa, what are the challenges now? I mean, you've kind of made it. You're playing professionally. Do you still have these moments of doubts where you're just like, oh my God, I can't believe it. I'm playing professionally. What do you do with the doubt now?
I'm not going to lie to you. It's still there. It still lingers. I think I still have a lot to prove. Yes, I've made it on a professional team. And yes, I've made it on a national team. In the end, I don't think that's enough. The whole idea is get to the World Cup, get to the Olympics. All right, you're there, get to the Final Four of both. You're there, win it. Because otherwise we won't be satisfied. We're competitors.
Soccer player Anissa Guajardo going for the World Cup with Mexico's national team. And sports and fitness writer Leana Carrasco, who profiled Anissa in Bigger, Faster, Stronger magazine. Check our website, latinousa.org, for a link to the article. Well, being a Latina, bueno, a veces las cosas se complican. So we've asked you to come to us with your Latina and Latino problems, and we've got some answers for you. We're in the studio now with Latina Magazine's advice columnist, Pauline Campos. Welcome, Pauline.
Hi, how are you?
Great. So are you ready to answer some Latino problems?
Bring it.
Okay.
Hi, this is Andrea.
So you have a Latino problem, eh?
Yes, I do. I'm a really light-skinned Latina, and I was wondering, to what extent is it all right to call myself a person of color, you know, being white in appearance, but still Latina being a big part of my identity?
Andrea, that's a great question. Pauline, what's your answer?
I am who I am. That's all you have to stick with. You're a Latina, you are a person of color, and no matter what anybody else thinks, doesn't matter. You go with how you feel and you identify with that and you own that and be part of it.
Andrea, let me ask you a question. How many times have you been asked, hey, are you really Mexican?
I get that all the time.
Have you been asked that question?
Mm-hmm. I get that when I say I'm Hispanic, I get that. You have short brown hair. You have very light skin. Are you really Hispanic? And I think one time I even said I called myself a student, a person of color. And my friends who are white were a little bit confused about that.
Question. White's a color, right? Okay, then. End of story. White's a color. You're done.
All right. Ka-ching. There you go. Andrea, thank you so much for calling us.
Thank you.
Who's on the call?
Hi, my name is Maria Reina, and I'm calling from Washington Heights in New York City.
Hey, Maria Reina, what a great name.
I love that name.
The Queen.
I know, it's beautiful.
It's beautiful. So Pauline Campos is here to give you advice on your Latino problem.
I'm a citizen of the U.S., and I have family members, some of whom are undocumented. And I have nieces and nephews that I'm trying to guide, hopefully be helped by something like the DREAM Act. But I'm trying to think about, as a family, how we can have this conversation so that everyone feels that we can support, you know, the decision for my nieces.
What you need to try and focus on is you want the topic addressed and you want everybody's feedback on that.
Absolutely. So that's a big challenge.
So, and it is a big challenge, but the first thing you're going to need to do is accept and make peace with the fact that you're going to make people mad before you make them mad. And then from there, let everybody know ahead of time, you know, you want to talk and you've got something serious you want to talk about. Obviously, you want to make sure that you bring up the topic with the family, but you do it in a way that isn't offensive. And you want everybody to know that, you know, you have everybody's best interests at heart.
Okay, and here's my piece of advice. Make sure that whatever you do, you serve a really wonderful, loving meal right before the conversation.
And have beer.
Yeah. And I've definitely seen a good meal do wonders.
Thank you, Maria Reina.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, who's on the line?
My name is Ricardo Latorre.
All right, and where are you calling from, Ricardo?
I'm calling from New York.
Great, Ricardo. What is your Latino problem?
Every time I try and find mole, I have to, like, drive up to 139th Street, which is, like, four or five stops away from where I live.
And you're not happy about that.
Not at all. This is one of my favorite dishes, and there's only about one or two places that I know of that sells the spice you need.
So, Pauline, we have a problem. Ricardo doesn't want to have to ride four or five extra stops on the subway to go get some real serious mole.
I have to admit, it's a bit of a heavy problem, but if I had to, like, take
this
a guess.
This is a Latino problem.
I totally get it.
Let me tell you, when I moved to New York in 1979, I had to bring my mole from Chicago, okay? And I still bring my tortillas from Chicago.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I'm just saying.
You know, have you thought of looking online to see if there's a website where you could possibly order what you need so you don't have to make those extra stops?
Yeah, I have, but a few times that I've actually found it, they sell it wholesale.
What about family that lives, where's your family from? Like, where's the rest of your family live?
My family's from Monterrey, Mexico.
Okay, so call your tías and be like, hey, tía, I love you, I miss you, and I need some spices so I can make mole because I love you and I miss you. Send me some?
Or even better, don't send the spices, send the mole already made.
There you go.
Yeah. Just FedEx them.
Here's one other piece of advice, Ricardo. I'm always on the lookout for women who are selling food on the street. Keep your eyes out because there are a lot of Mexican women now who sell homemade food on the streets of New York City, but you have to spot them. They don't have food carts. They're just on with their little shopping cart on the street. So I would say, abre los ojos, because they may be selling it right under your nose and you didn't even see it.
Wow. I'll definitely think about that.
All right. Sounds good.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Ricardo.
All right. Thanks. Nice talking to you.
Thanks, Pauline, for all of your great advice today on Latino USA.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Now, we want to hear from you. So, do you have a Latino problem? I bet you do. And, of course, you want to hear what Pauline has to say. So, tweet at us by using the hashtag LatinoProblems. And you can also email us at lusalatinoproblems@gmail.com. And now, the quinceañera. It's a rite of passage for a lot of Latinas, a way to celebrate young womanhood and to have a real party, but it wouldn't be a real party without dancing. Here for today's sabiduría, we have a little perspective from one woman who helps girls become women.
My name is Stephanie Owen. I am a quinceañera choreographer, dance instructor, and born and raised in San Francisco, California. My mother is 100% Nicaragüense, born and raised in Nicaragua. And I grew up listening actually to cumbia and merengue and salsa. There was a lot of that. Every morning in the car driving to school with salsa all the time in my mom's car, blasting.
That's the accordion playing, so when you hear that, you roll.
And my father was of Irish and Filipino descent, so I have a nice mixture going on. And my Spanish, I have to admit, isn't the greatest, but I grew up with nothing but Nicaraguense food, Nicaraguense mannerisms, tone of the voice. Everything is very Nicoya for me. Culturally, it's the what I learned from my heritage is humor and being very loud, but in a very humorous way, like just being, you know, joyful in your talk and in your walk, you know. I never imagined I would be a quinceañera choreographer. I volunteered first to get out there and teach kids dance, and the more quinceañeras I did more different styles of dance, and that's when I was introduced to ballroom and, you know, the typical Latin dances, salsa, merengue. I did more. So it's been quite a journey. I love to see the parents, the family's faces while they're seeing the choreography being done and how symbolic it is about the quinceañera's coming of age, you know? And then after we perform, then it's party time. It's like, all right, you guys did a great job. You know, it's just, it's happiness. That's really nice to watch.
I know, three, four, five.
That profile of Stephanie Owen was produced by Radio Bilingüe's Farida Chavala Romero. And to all of my compañeras latinas, gracias por escucharnos. Thanks for tuning in to this week's show. And to all of you caballeros, I hope you learned a thing or two. Latino USA is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Michael Simon Johnson, Daisy Rosario, Brenda Salinas, and Michael Jones. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Jonathan Wolf and Eva Delap are our interns. And Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Thanks to Jim Holland and the staff at WGN Radio. Special thanks to Sagal Radio and Hussein Mohammed in Decatur, Georgia. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find Latino USA on Facebook, Twitter, and on Tumblr. And check out my own Instagram. It's Maria_La_Hinojosa. And I'll see you on Facebook and on my own Twitter. Until next week, hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. News or Noise is funded by the Why News Matters initiative at the McCormick Foundation, fostering communities of educated, informed, and engaged citizens. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. The Lemelson Foundation, supporting investors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org. This is NPR.